This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. COVID-19 vaccines are rolling out, but in Ohio, only a small percentage of the doses are going into the arms of the state's Black population. We start the weekly news review now with Inquirer reporter Ann Saker, who joins us on the phone. Ann, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Michael.
Well, we're glad to have you on. What can you tell us as far as numbers or percentage of population related to Black people in Ohio receiving a COVID-19 vaccine?
We've been reporting for the last week some analyses that we have conducted on the percentage of people who have been getting vaccinations in Ohio so far. And what we found was a kind of a weird result, given that there's been such immense emphasis placed on the fact that we need to get vaccines to the people who need them most, and that's people in nursing homes and the frontline healthcare workers and to the folks who are most likely to be affected by COVID-19, which is we're seeing people who are Black and are Hispanic. And what we found is that of all the vaccinations that have been given out so far, only about 5% are going into Black Ohioans. And there are a couple of different layers of reasons for that. One is that the way that the distribution model got executed as directed from the federal government to the state government is that many providers were brought into the system, including hospitals and pharmacies. And for hospitals and pharmacies tended to be in whiter neighborhoods. And and we found that, particularly here in Hamilton County, there are 3 out of the 10 most African-American neighborhoods have no vaccination site to them. So the distribution is complicated also by the lack of supply. Don't have enough. We're not vaccinating as many as we should. And the third component is that the governor decided to emphasize age as a priority metric for delivering vaccines. So we wanted to do people who were over 60, over 80, then over 75, then over 70, and over 65. And that so far has left a lot of Black Ohioans out of the vaccination line.
What did you learn about why that is when we talk about the age situation? How does that particularly impact older Black people?
The large majority of people in nursing homes today are white. So the white population in those nursing homes got vaccinated before older Black Ohioans who are living either with their families or in other circumstances. And so the way that it just broke down in terms of supply and the distribution network, right now at the top of this effort to vaccinate people, it's left a lot of Black Ohioans just out of the line.
We've heard
since... Yeah, the governor has said repeatedly they're doing what they can to correct that problem. They're going to start vaccinating in large residential buildings next week, in 6 large residential buildings next week across the state. They are moving more into the federally qualified health centers. So they understand they have a problem and they're trying to correct it.
We've heard, Anne, since the beginning of this pandemic, when it turned deadly here in America, that the death rate was disproportionate among Black and brown communities. And I understand that the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus Foundation is raising particular concern about the low percentage of Black Ohioans who have been vaccinated. And one of the reasons cited in the report that you put out is that a lot of people are having automatic barriers to these things because these vaccination clinics are located in supermarket pharmacies, while a disproportionate number of Black people in Ohio live in what are described as food deserts, places without grocery stores. Is there an answer for that from the state's leaders?
The answer from Governor DeWine, who actually got a little irritated with my colleague Jackie Borchert when she pressed him on this week, is that they're trying to get they're working with a very limited supply and they're working off the distribution pattern the federal government set, which was to bring in a lot of these private providers. The other interesting wrinkle that the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus Foundation raised. The president and chief executive officer, Barbara Sykes, mentioned to me that the problem is that for a lot of white people, it's easy for us to blame the lack of trust within black Ohioans when it comes to medicine and to vaccinations in particular, when in fact the bigger problem is the lack of access. And once the lack of access is addressed, the lack of trust can be faced with better education and outreach. But she did not want, former Representative Sykes did not want news media or the state to be blaming the lack of trust within among black Ohioans as the reason that the vaccination is not getting into that population as quickly as we would like.
I'll emphasize a part of your reporting, Anne, in the Inquirer this week. Quote, there are currently no vaccination sites in 3 of the 10 Hamilton County zip codes with the highest percentages of black residents. That's about 20,000 people in those 3 zip codes that are primarily located in College Hill, Springfield Township, and North College Hill, Pleasant Ridge and Kennedy Heights, and Avondale, North Avondale, and St. Bernard. We're talking with Anne Saker, health reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. And Anne, you opened up your reporter's notebook in a story this week, Scenes from the Pandemic, the Inquirer's health writer considers 9 lessons of the coronavirus. You have a specialized beat there at the newspaper of record here in our city. And for the past year or so, your beat has been the story that's on all of our minds every single day. Can you talk a little bit about that transition to covering more specialized topics to the topic?
It's been overwhelming, Michael. I think every reporter, every journalist who's even had a glancing contact with this story gets overwhelmed by the size of it all. And this wasn't just covering medicine. This was covering the health of the world, the health of our nation, the health of our community in a profound way that affected all of us. Even if you weren't sick, you were touched by it in some way. You had a child home from school. You had parents in a nursing home. You had to work from home, or you lost your job, or there was the consequences from this were all in all of us, in every home. And I think the essay I wrote this week was more an exercise in me trying to understand what was happening to us in a way that was hard to do when you were chasing the story 24 hours a day. So it was just a moment for me to sit back and say, what do I know from this now? What have I learned here? And it was a good exercise for me. I'm so honored and pleased that the Inquirer ran it. And I feel really extraordinarily lucky that in my career, I came to a point where I can study the subject of medicine and healthcare, and why it's important to us, and then have it explode into this worldwide phenomenon. It's overwhelming and exciting in the usually, you know, journalism perverse way, but also very humbling. And I'm glad to be here. And the readers have been awesome too.
Well, we're appreciative for the reporting as well. And the first lesson that you list is we didn't move fast enough. And so when we think back to, say, 1 year ago today, we hadn't shut down yet. I don't even know if we had cases in our area yet, but we didn't move fast enough. When you look back in hindsight, what can you say to expand upon that thought?
It's not that we didn't know this was coming. We knew by the end of December of 2019 that there was a mysterious pneumonia spreading in Wuhan, China. And normally the United States puts epidemiologists and infectious disease people on planes and gets them to the site and so they can watch it and monitor it. And that did not happen. Once we started realizing that the borders could not be completely sealed and that it was coming for us, we were slow off the dime in trying to figure out what is the best way to preserve the health, emotional and physical and economic health of our nation. And we just didn't take the actions we needed to take in January of last year, which is one that would have made a difference.
I note that what struck me in reading these 9 lessons you learned, Anne, was that a lot of the other areas that you already cover as a health reporter are impacting the survival rates for people, even in our area. We've heard a lot about comorbidities and the vulnerability you have to COVID-19 if you possess those. And you note in the lessons that you've learned in the report published in The Inquirer that our region is fatter than the national average. We smoke more. We get less sleep. Childhood asthma rates are higher. We're sicker with heart disease, cancer, diabetes. We had the opioid epidemic, childhood obesity. You spend time in the past writing about those issues. Do you think that we as a region have learned about perhaps better improving our overall general health in the wake of this deadly pandemic?
I think the pandemic certainly has put that subject front and center. And we see this now clearly that your health affects my health, my neighbor's health affects my other neighbor's health, that we're all interconnected to each other. And our health policy going forward and our health attitudes going forward cannot ignore that any longer. We are all involved in this project of good health. And the big problem, of course, is that fixing this is going to take 30 years. And the question becomes, do we have the patience and the willpower to do it for 30 years, to bend the curve that way? I think if any place can, it's Cincinnati, Ohio. So that's the story I'm going to be following going forward, is how we recover from this.
Well, speaking of patience and willpower, one of the lessons you write about learning during the pandemic and your coverage of it is we reopened too soon. And I think that's a sentiment shared by a lot of people who were surprised to see that when cases started to surge a couple of times over the course of this pandemic and we increased restrictions, perhaps on restaurants and other gathering opportunities, and then we reopen our access to them in spite of the fact that the current caseload at that moment had not gone down. What can you tell us about your learning about having reopened too soon?
Well, as we've seen throughout the years since then, economic reports and epidemiological reports that show that if we had been able to hold on a little longer, maybe another 2 weeks, we would have really effectively crushed the curve in such a way that with extended masking and social distancing, we could have peeled back with a lot more certainty that we were not going to let the virus go rip-snorting through the population once again. And unfortunately, it was peeling it back just a little prematurely. I know that it's hard for people to understand that, but viruses work on their own patterns in their own ways, and they will take every opportunity they can to spread. And that's what we did. We opened the door too soon, and the virus blossomed in our environment. So we've seen in places such as Vietnam and New Zealand, and even in parts of Italy and in China, of course, when they clamped down and they stayed down for sometimes 3 months, it's gone. They're having soccer tournaments in Australia now because they were able to crack down. I know that it was hard, and we want to think that it's drugs that solve all our problems, but sometimes it's changing the behavior and maintaining that change in behavior. It turns the corner.
You can read more of Ann Saker's lessons learned from covering the pandemic, as well as her other reporting inside the Cincinnati Inquirer and at cincinnati.com. Ann Saker, thank you so much for the time you gave us.
Have a great weekend, Michael. Thank you so much.
And now to the Brent Spence Bridge, where despite a disruptive weeks-long closure, there still doesn't appear to be a concrete plan to move forward with a more long-term fix for the crowded I-75-71 corridor. WKRC-TV reporter James Pilcher joins us now via Zoom. James, welcome back to our program.
Good afternoon, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, in the wake of that significant disruption to our lives when the Brent Spence Bridge closed down on top of dealing with the pandemic, the question arose, is this an opportunity to reevaluate what our priorities are in relation to that bridge? And I'm wondering what you found. Are lawmakers doing such a thing while the General Assembly is in session in Frankfurt right now?
Maybe behind the scenes, there might be some conversations going on, but there's been nothing concrete. And earlier this week, the deadline to introduce new legislation in this particular session passed. Now, they could still attach something to existing bills if they wanted to, but all I'm hearing is, yeah, we're talking about it, but again, there's been nothing concrete. The big elephant in the room remains tolls. Most people in Northern Kentucky don't want them. They feel it's an unfair burden on them, but it's the only way to raise the money that's going to be necessary to completely cover it, cover the cost of the $2.6 billion it's going to take to pay for it, because the federal government is not stepping up like it used to pay for this kind of thing.
Well, you have covered the Brent Spence Bridge for a long time, and it's been a topic.
20 years, Michael.
Exactly. It has been a topic of conversation since before I was old enough to drive across it. So it's Kentucky lawmakers themselves who, not that long ago, approved legislation at the behest of the Northern Kentucky delegation to flat out prohibit the use of tolls in future plans for construction of the bridge. Is that right?
It's called the Arnold Simpson Amendment, named after the now retired representative from Covington, Arnold Simpson. Basically any new bridge across the Ohio, and that means because it's across the Ohio, Kentucky owns it. Any new bridge across the Ohio cannot have tolls on it.
I thought it was interesting that you spoke with State Senator Chris McDaniel. He's a Republican from Taylor Mill who represents Covington and Northern Kenton County in the state legislature. He's begun to wield a lot of influence down there, and he characterized the conversation as, quote, the good news is that it went into the forefront of everyone's minds. And I'm wondering, James, based on that, you would think there would have been a piece of legislation filed, maybe.
Well, I still think they're just... I really don't have an answer for, they say they're working on it, but then they don't have anything concrete. I don't have an answer. I think they're still trying to figure out how to politically cover themselves and somehow re-raise the toll issue. There's also this, they've got to figure out how to back out of this conversation about instead of a bridge building this, for years, the red herring or the false flag became, oh, we need a bypass. We need an eastern bypass, which would have cost more money and taken even longer. But it was a way to get around having to deal with the bridge as an alternative. Well, now that's out there, so people are turning to that. But the accident and the closure showed the immediacy of the need now. So it's a politically difficult situation for the people. They painted themselves into a box politically, and I still think that's part of what they're trying to do, is to extricate themselves from that. The other issue is that I think they're waiting to see what's going to come out of Washington, because the Biden administration is with a new transportation secretary, Pete Buttigieg, is going to really push hard to raise for the first time in decades the federal highway tax, which could raise more money for major infrastructure. So I think they're just kind of waiting and seeing and saying, maybe hope against hope that the feds come up with more money, and therefore they don't have to have this conversation around tolls.
Well, you know as well as anyone, it's been so interesting to watch this, the way that different officials at different levels of government will, I shouldn't say pass the buck, but direct our attention to a different level of government. So you have the federal government, who often say that the state legislatures need to get their act together and have a full plan before any federal dollars can come. You'll hear from the legislature that local officials in Northern Kentucky are adamantly opposed to tolls, so you can't put that in. Two press conferences from the past come to mind, James, in the period that I've been covering this issue as well. One involved chambers of commerce on both sides of the river. I think it's been about a decade where they came together and launched some initiative, I believe was called Build Our New Bridge Now. And if you read that old report where they had come out and there would have been tolls involved, the bridge would have been constructed in full and finished and reopened by now. And the other one, and I think I might have even seen you there, was at the River Center Towers. Two governors, John Kasich of Ohio, a Republican, and Steve Beshear of Kentucky, a Democrat, came together to say, we're going to split the cost on this. Let's get moving. And still, there's nothing. And you,
I was at both of those conferences.
Exactly. Me too. And so you
bring it up. And to be honest, it came up during the campaign. They came up, when Mitch McConnell was basically saying, hey, our hands are tied at the federal level. You guys got to figure out what you're going to do at the state level. And it's up to the state. It's up to the state to prioritize it. We just give you the money. Well, you and I know both know that's not quite true. I mean, he was one of the driving forces to get the Louisville bridges built. Now, granted, Louisville agreed and Indiana agreed to pay tolls there. So that was a different situation. And it took them 10 years to finally agree on all that. But we were going on 25 years of debating what to do about this bridge here in Cincinnati in northern Kentucky. So, yeah, I mean, you know, all I can tell you is I'm going to continue to ask the question because, I mean, I figure I'm going to continue to write about this bridge until I retire. And I'm not going to go away. I'm going to continue to ask, what are you doing about it? Especially now we have this glaring example of what would happen if something even worse were to happen.
Well, there's another Beshear in the governor's mansion in Frankfort. Steve Beshear's son, Andy Beshear, is now governor, and he doesn't seem to have the same type of messaging that Steve Beshear had on this. You did ask him about the future, and just as we noted moments ago, he said, quote, in northern Kentucky, we still need the local committee to come together to support one plan that we can ultimately fund. So I think
it gets back to the other question where they were talking about, oh, we're going to do a bypass. No, we're going to put it all through Fort Wright. No, we're going to do, you know, so there's always been these other, you know, I don't know, land grabs or development dreams or whatever that, you know, others are trying to put out. And yet the traffic studies show that 60 to 70% of the truck traffic on that bridge makes local stops. So they can't just shift all the truck traffic around Cincinnati because most of them, given the logistics of Cincinnati, given the fact that we're a logistical hub and a manufacturing hub, most of those trucks stop inside the loop somewhere. So they need to use the bridge.
We're talking with James Pilcher, a reporter at WKRC Local 12. James, we all know about the Brent Spence Bridge, but we don't often get to know so well the federal prosecutor who is assigned to our various districts across the country. We have certainly gotten to know, at least over the past year, a man named David DeVillers, the district U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Ohio. You talked to him, and he became a face that started to be familiar to us because of his role in prosecuting members of Cincinnati City Council. Tell us about your conversation.
Well, this is the second time I've been able to interview a federal prosecutor in Cincinnati. And in both times, it's when they're both are considered short timers or they don't have much longer in their offices. So, you know, the last one was Ben Glassman, and he knew he was on his way out because he had been appointed by a Democratic Congress and the Trump administration was in the process of clearing all those out. And now, you know, with the Biden administration taking over and David DeVillers having been appointed last year by President Trump and a Republican Senate, it's only a matter of time before they replace him, which makes it supposedly a nonpartisan position. Yet all of these prosecutors roll over whenever there's a change in administration. So it's kind of an interesting thing. You know, there's a lot of people cynically would say, well, he's out there just trying to look for a job. He's out there, trying to taint the jury pool because of these prosecutions, which also include the former Ohio Speaker of the House, Larry Householder, in the whole First Energy debacle. He's got him under indictment as well. I came away with a sense that, no, I mean, these positions are inherently political. There's no denying that. But I came away with the sense that this guy has been a prosecutor his entire life. He can play the politics, but he just basically wants to put who he thinks bad guys are in jail. So, you know, it's all he's known his entire life. He helped prosecute Saddam Hussein for war crimes for the Justice Department. So, you know, I also came away with he did not fit the mold of your traditional, you know, straitjacketed federal prosecutor, FBI agent, close to the vest. He was funny. He has a very dry, funny, witty sense of humor. He has months left in the job and maybe he's rattling his saber, but he said, stay tuned, there may be more to come. So I don't know what to make of that. He wouldn't offer specifics on that or on his feelings on any of the ongoing prosecutions. I asked him what he thinks about releasing the audio from the meeting Sittenfeld had with the undercover agents and the informants, and he declined to talk about that too.
It's not unusual for prosecutors at the federal level to preemptively resign if a new president of a different party takes over. We saw it in the Eastern District of Kentucky back in January. Trump appointee Robert Duncan, and that district includes Northern Kentucky, so we get to know this gentleman as well. He resigned, and it doesn't look like David DeVillers is going to resign. Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat of Ohio, did say that DeVillers should be replaced. So does he accept that it's imminent?
Yes, he does. But he's also in a different position because a lot of those Trump appointees came from outside the Justice Department. And he's a lifer. I mean, he's known nothing but been a prosecutor in Franklin County, and then he went to work for the Justice Department, made his way all the way up to assistant U.S. attorney. So he's known nothing but this. So, you know, when they appointed him, they appointed him from within. So it isn't like he is overly political. But he said he's talked to Brown. And he said because of his position, he's being given a little bit more leash than someone like you said, Duncan, and that he's going to have a few months to kind of straighten things up, to get a couple more cases maybe indicted or prosecuted, and then get everything ready for whoever comes in to replace him. And Brown, what's funny about these positions is that, you know, they're supposedly non-political, yet politicians can nominate them. So Brown is actually accepting applications for this job.
James Pilcher is a reporter with WKRC-TV Local 12. You can watch and read his reporting there. James, always a pleasure to have you on. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you, Michael.
And up next, a Cincinnati City councilman apologizes to another councilman. And we take you back to the first dating ads published by a Cincinnati newspaper and the uproar they caused. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with WVXU reporters Corey Sharber and Becca Costello. Corey, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
And Becca, hello to you.
Hello.
Becca, let's start with what the headline at WVXU.org characterizes as a kumbaya moment. That is a direct quote, actually, from Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley after a discussion and vote related to updating the city's hate crime ordinance. But there was another kumbaya moment, I suppose, involving a couple of council members. Councilman Greg Landsman offered an apology to Councilman Chris Smitherman, which was accepted. Did you watch that?
I did. It was kind of a surprising moment. You know, I'm pretty new to this beat, but the tension at city council committee and full council meetings has been pretty apparent. So this was kind of a remarkable moment. I mean, a little bit of history here. Councilman Landsman was part of what's come to be known as that Gang of Five and those text messages that have come out. Some of those very critical of Smitherman, especially considering the difficulties that he was going through with his wife, who had breast cancer at the time. She has since passed away. And Landsman has been kind of the least involved in that Gang of Five text messages. He personally didn't say anything critical of Smitherman and that difficulty that they were going through. And yet he still apologized for his involvement in that and said, you know, he wishes he had spoken up at that time, that he hadn't been so sort of focused on his own concerns. And even more remarkable, there was kind of about 15 minutes there of their back and forth, and Mr. Smitherman said that he forgives him.
Yes, it was about 15 minutes. I watched some of the video online. It was quite a moment considering the tension and the disruption at Cincinnati City Hall recently. I encourage people to just check that out for observational purposes and form their own opinions about it. But the other kumbaya moment, the one the Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley referenced, is in relationship to the hate crime ordinance being updated to include gender identity and gender expression as protected categories. What can you tell us?
So So one thing that's important to note is that transgender individuals were already protected under the ordinance. So this was kind of a cleaning up the language kind of thing. Previously, transgender status was included under the definition of sexual orientation, which is just kind of factually incorrect. And so Councilmember Chris Seelbach put forward this proposal to make that more explicit and include gender identity and gender expression. These are issues, LGBTQ equality issues, that Seelbach has been focused on for pretty much his whole time on council. But what was maybe a little bit surprising was hearing some of the Republican members of council speak in support of this and say, you know, this is the right thing to do to protect all Cincinnatians, but it also makes good business sense to say, you know, we want to attract businesses here and we want our businesses to be able to recruit employees, and being protective and inclusive of all people is an important part of that. So Councilmember Liz Keating, who's relatively new to council, you know, congratulated Seelbach on his work on these issues. And it was a little bit, you know, kind of a, like we said, Mayor Cranley called it a kumbaya moment and said, wow, we're really kind of exchanging some heartfelt feelings here.
That's Becca Costello from here at WVXU. We're also joined by WVXU reporter Corey Sharber. Corey, not much kumbaya at the Cincinnati Public School District as far as the relationship between district administrators and the teachers' union. They ended up in the court of law before returning to school.
Yeah, I don't think a lawsuit is necessarily a kumbaya moment. So what happened over the weekend? On Friday, the Cincinnati Federation of Teachers filed an injunction request against CPS. They are, of course, wanting to halt a return to in-person learning, which started on Monday. That, of course, went to court same day, and Judge Lisa Allen rejected that request. A lot of teachers are pretty peeved about the decision, to be quite frank.
Well, what was the teacher's position? We are seeing similar arguments from teachers' unions across the country. What did the local union have to say about their hesitance to return to in-person learning?
Well, of course, like the biggest concern, obviously, is we're in the middle of a pandemic, and a lot of teachers are going back to school without having received the second dose of the vaccine. Even survey that was put out by the teachers union, I believe 80% of them, of course, were really aggravated about the decision to return. 80% of them did not feel safe going back into classrooms without receiving both of the doses.
It's probably going to be a challenge, I would imagine, moving forward with the teachers union and the district administrators, because these are entities that have to come together and agree to contracts. So was there any comment on that relationship moving forward, even beyond the pandemic?
Well, CFT still plans to go forth with arbitration against CPS. I mean, the main thing that mainly started all of this, President Julie Sellers, when I spoke to her on Saturday after the news got out about the lawsuit coming forth, she just straight up said that the reason for it was that they had not received any input. The teachers were not, you know, the board did not seek any input from the teachers. And that, of course, raises a lot of eyebrows from the teachers union, especially considering the county was purple at the time the decision to return to school was made. And they just seemed very left out of it, especially at a very volatile time as this. Going forward, I mean, it just seems like, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see.
Corey, in other COVID-19 related news, the Hamilton County Commission passed a resolution to create an economic recovery and relief task force. What do they hope to accomplish?
Right. So this was passed in the Hamilton County Commission earlier this week. The task force is hoping to be able to hopefully, you know, provide an avenue for some relief to residents and businesses within Hamilton County. What this could accomplish, of course, is mainly, of course, with rapid relief coming to residents first and foremost, and of course, aiding businesses with this really difficult time. In the future, though, they want to create a separate force within the task force, which is, when I first read that, I got super confused and had a little bit of a headache. But once I figured it out, basically what it will do is eventually they will appoint members to that external force, and they will focus on rebuilding the economy and investing in the future of the county.
Okay, and let's turn back to Becca Costello now from WVXU. Becca, to continue with the theme, it wasn't all kumbaya at Cincinnati City Hall in recent days. There was a controversial development at Liberty and Elm Streets. That finally did receive approval. What can you tell us?
Yeah, what's interesting about this project is it got a lot of public pushback from residents and community advocates saying, you know, there's no affordable housing on this mixed-use development at Liberty and Elm and over the Rhine. And so the public was really saying, hey, we don't want anyone to approve this right now. As far as council goes, you know, there was lots of discussion about how they thought the project could be better, but the split vote in approving it was actually just approving, one version of the project over another. So there was some discussion about should we include some of these not quite affordable housing, but a little bit cheaper units in the project. But in order to do that, they would the developers would be paying less money into a city fund for the streetcar. And so really the full council supported one version of the project, and the one they ended up approving is kind of the one that they had 2 weeks ago before they delayed the vote, hoping they could get some affordable housing. So that project is moving forward after a lot of public discussion about it.
And you can read more reporting from Becca and from Corey, as well as our other fine reporters here at WVXU, like Tana and Bill and Ann, at WVXU.org. Becca Costello, thank you for the time. Corey Sharber, we've got some aspirin in the break room if you still have a headache. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for the aspirin.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. John Keysweater is the WVXU media beat writer and joins us now via Zoom. Hey, John.
How you doing?
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Keys. And let's talk a little bit about baseball, at least baseball broadcasting. We all recall the controversy surrounding Tom Brenneman after his homophobic slur aired on television. He's been replaced. What can you tell us about John Sadak?
John Sadak has worked for CBS and Westwood One. He's also got like 15 years in the minor leagues doing games for franchises in New Jersey, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. And he'll join the Fox Sports Ohio team as the play-by-play man this spring. And boy, it's nice on a cold day like this to be talking baseball.
Oh, I know you and Howard Wilkinson love the Reds. And so this will be different hearing his voice. What's it like as a fan when a new voice takes over in a booth?
It takes a while, more so in radio because it's more intimate. But I think Tommy Thrall has had a real smooth transition there on radio. And on TV, I mean, the real good play-by-play guy sets it up, and you're able to watch the action, and is friendly to introduce the comments, be open to the comments from Jeff Brentley or Chris Welsh as the analyst.
I did see a video from John Sadak on Twitter talking about this. He's got a great voice, so it will be a pleasure to listen to. What did he have to say about taking this gig?
Well, he said, calling Major League Baseball games full-time has been my career goal and life goal for many years. So I wish him well. It's time for a new start.
Well, let's move on to something that I might have more interest in. Hollywood awards season. We love that. And the Golden Globe nominations and the Screen Actors Guild nominations are out. And Hillbilly Elegy, the film version of the novel set in Middletown, did not go unnoticed. Tell us.
Well, that's true. The Golden Globes, Glenn Close got a nomination for Best Supporting Actress. And then the next day, on Thursday, Screen Actors Guild came out and Glenn Close again for Supporting Actress. But Amy Adams was nominated as the female leading role for her role as Bev, the mother of J.D. Vance in his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. So she didn't really campaign for it, neither did the studio. So that was a nice nod for her. And some people see the SAG nominations and awards as a precursor to the Oscars, which would be good for either Amy or Glenn because they've each had 6 or 7 nominations for Oscars, but have never won an Oscar.
It's shocking. I didn't know that Glenn Close had never won an Oscar until she had just done a video back and forth with his name escapes me. One of the guys from Saturday Night Live, but that came up and she'd been nominated so many times and I was really surprised that she had never won. So I'm sure she's hoping. I'm wondering what you think about that particular nomination though, because you had some pretty strong observations about the film version of Hillbilly Elegy when it came out.
Well, yeah, I still have a lot of friends in Middletown. In fact, my cousins and my aunts grew up on McKinley Street where the Vance family lived. And they've all said, and the buzz in Middletown is that Glenn Close really nailed the part of J.D.'s grandma, Mama, or Bonnie Vance, as she was known, where she lived on McKinley Street. So that didn't surprise me, but I'm just wondering, you know, with so many other strong performances in movies this past year, and particularly for Amy Adams, if she's up against like Viola Davis from Ma Rainey's Black Bottoms, I think it's going to be tough.
Gosh, there's so much good content out there these days, and we've all certainly had a lot of time to catch up on it. So it will be interesting to see who comes out on top when those trophies are handed out later. Let's talk about another local entity headed to the smaller screen. Everything But the House is headed to television. What can you tell us about that?
The Blue Ash e-commerce business, next week, HGTV is expected to announce the March premiere for the Everything But the House show. It's done with the staffers from Everything But the House and with Lara Spencer, who many people know from Good Morning America, but she's also been the host of Flea Market Flip on HGTV for 9 years and a big flea market person, and apparently was a champion of this project. And so the Everything But the House co-founder Jackie Denny and 10 staffers spent July, August, and September in on the East Coast filming 7 episodes. And that plus a pilot filmed almost 2 years ago will air as the 8 episodes coming sometime in March or this spring.
Sometime in March. We don't know specifically when the release is coming.
Not yet. The HGTV is supposed to announce that next week.
All right, we'll keep an eye out on that. And you can always read John Keith's sweater at WVXU.org. Hey, Keith, before I let you run, Super Bowl Sunday is coming up. It's the Chiefs and the Buccaneers, but a lot of us are way more concerned about the commercials. Which ones are you looking for?
I'm looking for, I mean, a big deal about the Budweiser not being in it, but Anheuser-Busch has got plenty of spots, including one called where a Bud Light truck wrecks and there's beer all over the road and what they call Bud Light legends, characters from past commercials like the Knight in Armor and even the little Bud Light bottles from the Bud Bowl come and help clean up the mess. There's another one I'm looking forward to with the P&G's Tide that's got Jason Alexander in a spot with a kid who's got Jason Alexander's face on a hoodie. And DoorDash has Cookie Monster and Grover from Sesame Street.
Oh, that should be fun. You said no Budweiser, though. Does that mean no Clydesdales this year?
Well, there's an asterisk on that because, yes, there's not going to be a traditional Budweiser, Clydesdales horses and puppies and whatnot, but there is going to be a Lean on Me Spirit of America spot and even showing people getting the vaccine. But in New York and Boston, apparently only these two markets, Sam Adams has done an ad with Clydesdales in which the Clydesdales run wild and create chaos in a city to promote a Sam Adams product. But it's only going to be a regional ad on the East Coast, New England, and not national. But I you can see it online.
Our technical director, Josh Elstro, wants to know if you've had a chance to see the Dolly Parton Squarespace commercial.
Yes, that's a revamp of Dolly Parton's 9 to 5 called 5 to 9. She's done new lyrics for it. She sings a song that is about people when the clock hits 5 and from the evening hours, they can use that time to in praise of entrepreneurs and small business people. And it's pretty clever.
Lastly, who do you got, Chiefs or Bucks?
I really don't care. I just hope for a good game and even better commercials.
I hope both teams have a great time. That's John Keysweater, WVXU media beat writer. Please read his great coverage of the local media scene and national entertainment stuff at WVXU.org. Keys, thanks for the time. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michael.
And now for a look at strange moments in Cincinnati history. We're joined by Cincinnati Magazine contributor and the curator of Cincinnati Curiosities, Greg Hand. Greg, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
It is always a pleasure indeed. I know a lot of us single folks are singular, more single than ever since you can't really get out and date these days because of social distancing requirements. But I'm sure when this is over, there will be a lot of personal ads and a lot more action on the apps. This isn't new, though. You wrote this really cool piece for Cincinnati Magazine about the first time the Inquirer published some quasi-personal ads, and it outraged the community. Tell us about it.
Well, the thing that came out in researching this is just how different things were in the past. Everybody knows what a personal ad is, a classified ad aimed at a person. But these ads appeared at a time when women basically were property, and particularly young unmarried women were considered valuable property of their fathers. And their fathers controlled all the access to their unmarried daughters. They controlled who they were allowed to talk to. They controlled the mail. They controlled where they went in public, that sort of thing. And so when young swains would spot a woman on the street and catch her eye and place a personal ad that says, would the young lady, for instance, who saw the gentleman in the gray suit at 6th and Vine, please respond to a letterbox at the Inquirer in response to this ad. That was just absolutely immoral behavior.
It's like the old, it's the misconnections section on Craigslist.
Exactly.
I want to read some of the ones that you pulled as examples. Quote, meet me at same place as usual tomorrow night, M. Quote, Fred of Covington would like to see you Saturday night at 8:30 at 5th and Walnut Streets, Kitty. And so these desperate longings from people like M and Kitty really enraged some local leaders, including Archbishop William Henry Elder. That's
right.
Well-known name
in
our community.
Yes.
So we have a right here in this city, a daily newspaper unfit to be read by any human being, much less a Christian. I mean, they were upset.
Exactly. This was a time, recall, when it was insulting to address a woman on the street. If a woman was walking down the street and a man even addressed her, even said hello, that was considered an insult. The only women who could be approached by gentlemen, strangers on the street, were common prostitutes. And so readers looked at these advertisements simply as an in-print variation on gentlemen addressing prostitutes. And the implication was that the daughters, the respectable daughters who were being addressed, were considered prostitutes. And that's where the outrage came from.
You can read this fascinating story at CincinnatiMagazine.com or in the issue of Cincinnati Magazine. Greg Hand is also the curator of Cincinnati Curiosities. Google it. It's always full of fascinating information. Greg, I promised to plug some of the other stories you had published that we wanted to talk about before we ran short of time. I'm not going to do it because I'm going to reach out in a couple of weeks. I got to have you back on because we do need to talk about some of these stories. I hope you'll accept my invitation and my apologies for having so little time for you today.
I shall await the invitation.
Thank
Always
you.
Good to talk to you, Michael.
Likewise, Greg. We'll talk again soon, I promise. And thank you, listeners. We made it to Friday. I hope you have a great weekend, too. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. I'm Michael Monks. Talk again Monday.